Contemporary art and some of the problems of it, that, you know, there's a real problem with terminologies. If you're going to become a minister and or you're going to work in a ministry situation, and then, you know, you have to do a commission for church art, there are a lot of problems, and they seem to boil down to taste. Because when we look at art, we are all allowed to have an opinion about it, as I said yesterday. And sometimes it's like, I like this, and then the other person says, I don't like this, and that's all you get to do. So that's all you get to discuss. And we don't really learn in our MDivs and in our programs how to critique art in a way that's more than just my visceral response to it. I like it or I don't like it. Now, I'm just going to warm you up with an exercise. I'm going to ask you each to decide, without any information about this. Now, you guys, you might want to move over this way, because I have to stand somewhere where I'm not in the way, because I'm a formidable obstacle. Anyway, we're going to look at this, and I'm going to ask you which one you would personally buy, assuming you could afford it. And these are all cross images, so let's just assume these are all religious images. So which one would you personally like to have in your home? And let's assume they fit as well. In fact, these are all crucifixes of a type. So you don't have to worry about size. Let's just assume that they all fit. And those are the ones I'm going to show you. Now, do you have any questions before you make a selection? Okay, just shout it out. This is plexiglass. It's actually large, but let's say you could have a smaller version of it, like a museum reproduction. Pardon? You like it, okay, but this is what we're gonna get at, aren't we? Let's just have a vote. Okay, raise hand, and can I have a secretary in the lot? Okay, thank you. If you could just keep the vote, we'll call this one Hat Man. So how many people would buy this personally? That's a one, there's no wrong answer. One, two, three, and four, definitely, back there. Okay, so four of these. This is a very minimal torso type of figure. Anybody want this one? One, got a modernist.
He's a Russian.
Watch out, one there. Well, he's gonna get the best value for his dollar, you'll see. Now, this is a 2 foot high, very abstract crucifix, but if you'll notice, silver, like Judas's 30 pieces, has been melted down into the spike, spikes it to the wall through what is actually a piece of fruit that has this blood red lining, so it's also like a womb. So that relates to Mary, and then what you think of as a stem is being driven out, which is a Genesis, part of the Genesis prediction, and that spike is also holding this joint to the wall, and the joint is kind of vulnerable looking, like a knee shape. So, and it's covered in gold, and last night I was saying that gold is always a metaphor in some ways for God. It's a precious and unified substance, and also very valuable. So, with that ad, anyone for this? Have a one? Wow, something's going to come up really big at the end. Okay, how about this one? Another minimalist approach. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Okay, seven for the Salt Lick Cross. Uh-huh. You thought it was high art, didn't you?
Well, I like the needle a lot more.
All right, the last one is an implied cross. You have the altar, which actually is real in this case, but you wouldn't have to have it in your home. And you have blood or fire, prophets of Baal fire or blood of Christ, and an implied cross in that netting. Anybody for this one? So I have one, two, three, four. Okay, I have four for these. All right, now let's go back. And I want you to look at these again, and I'll explain anything you want me to about them. But let me say that what if your church group put you in charge with a certain amount of money, and you could afford all of these pieces. And they said, now please select one of these for your church, and you have to bring it to them and stand up for it and say, this is why I think this fits in my church. So think about the choices again as I go back. Anywhere in your church, by the way. Doesn't have to be in an important place. Could be the foyer. All right. So saying that, how many people would buy this for their church? Did you vote for this before, Jason?
Yeah.
Okay. And did you vote for this before? All right, so you like this so much. Let's go on. Let me just go through this. And we had one vote or two, right? Okay, would you buy this for your church? Okay, for your office. Well, what about for your everybody to look at in the sanctuary, though? The last one. Okay, so you're going to change your vote, in fact. And that's what I'm actually interested in, people who change their vote. This one? Too Catholic. Not really. How about this one for your church? So did you change? Okay, so did you change? Well, this is an oddly consistent group of people. It's not working. It's supposed to completely change. And this one. Okay, who changed this one? All right, why did you change? Let me ask the other cross, this gentleman, described as the Russian. That is no slur in my mind, sir.
I would think that this one would be more publicly appropriate, more exclusive, and that one would be more exclusive, I would say.
What kind of church?
For any church.
What kind of church do you go to?
Mm-hmm.
And so this would work better in that church, let's say, than this. So, and I'm not putting you on the spot necessarily, but we have to think, okay, the point of this is that supposedly many of you would have changed your idea about which one you would choose for your church, but you didn't do that because you are consistent. Yeah. For example, I said you would get your bang for the buck because this is actually nothing to do with a religious theme. It's just a beautiful form by Isamu Noguchi in the Museum of Modern Art and costs millions of dollars. So, yeah, right, you see? Very good. But in fact, this doesn't have the religious meaning behind it at all. It's simply a beautiful form, but we could translate it into a torso. If you look at this one, this is an oil painting about 4 feet wide. It's called Fedora Shekinah, and it doesn't have any, like your church might say, but this has no cross in it. What's the deal? But of course you'd say, well, but it has this ladder. It has this implied vertical relationship to God and this implied horizontal relationship. I don't know if you went that far thinking about it. And it shows a person in an attitude of extreme humility, and we should be reminded of that. Plus, because it's a work of realism and figurativism, it's extremely pleasing to look at. And there's actually even more. If you went into this, there's a whole story behind how this got made and who that person is and what happened to that person after they modeled for this painting.
There's also something about the shape of it. Is that the shape of the canvas?
Yeah, intentionally. Well, yeah, there you have that too. I'm looking at time, and I'm going to move on because our real point of discussion is not these. This was just a warm-up. But now, you changed your mind from which to which?
From this one to the last one.
To the last one, and what church do you go to? What denomination?
Baptist.
Well, surprise me. Anyway, so and what would that, why would that be acceptable there?
Although that probably shouldn't be the case, I think
Mm-hmm. That just seems prettier for a church.
Prettier. So there's that aspect. You'd have to convince people. Now, and yet some of you chose this and didn't change your mind for your church. Tell me what kind of church, if you feel like it, and why you think this would be good. This is about 3 feet, 4 feet high. Yes. Uh-huh. So the material, texture. Well, in fact, the Salt Lake Cross was created by cows. This is a picture of that work being made. This is supposed to be a huge laugh right here. Because, you know, salt, thank you, salt is like a candy, and bovine animals need to lick salt as part of their digestive process, plus they love it. So the artist attached these salt licks, literally farm salt licks, to a steel plate with a steel armature, and then really put it in the pasture, and the metaphor was that the cows, wherever they were, came to it. You see, they came to it. So that's built into that piece, and that they couldn't resist it. That's built into that piece as a theological truth, you know, more than just that the cows licked it, you know, which you could say, well, that seems to be very ick. But, you know, cows licking, actually, if you think about it, it's a nurturing kind of process as well. So getting the cross away from them was quite difficult, however. So, but the artist has made a number of these that people have bought because they have a certain pleasing aesthetic quality. Sorry, it's not wood, it's steel and salt, but, you know, material is part of it too. What church am I in? Most of our churches look more like this, probably, I'm guessing. You know, hangers, kind of. So whatever we put in there is appropriate. Well, what we're actually going to do today, I'm going to spend 10 minutes warming you up, okay? A similar idea. You are the church commission for this particular church, believe it or not. This church is in Heidelberg, Germany, but that doesn't matter. This church was the University of Heidelberg's church for 6 centuries, just a little bit older than Southern. And this church is, we're looking at this church, is in a town that survives on tourism. So you got to know that this actual sanctuary is not so much a place of worship as a place of tourism. Tourists come to this and look at this. And so the university was founded by the people who inhabited this castle. And if you know about Heidelberg, this is one of the greatest Gothic, I'm sorry, well, one of the greatest romanticist castles. It's now mostly a ruin. But Goethe went to it, and over the centuries, many poets went to this ruin, this picturesque ruin on the top of this hill in Heidelberg. And this is a reconstruction of it. But nevertheless, Ruprecht, seen here, sort of. Ruprecht is the one that founded the university, but he was also a king of the region, which is a very fertile region that has often been warred against because it is so fertile. So try to put yourself in this mode. You belong to this very shrinking parish. It's only 100 parish members. And there is a commission of theologians, people from the University of Heidelberg, which some of you may know has a very important role in modernist theology. So there was a strong theology department there through the 50s, 40s, unorthodox for us, but strong. Anyway, Ruprecht founded this church, and then he decided to put a library inside of it. Now, from the church bell tower, we look at the old University of Heidelberg, founded in 1386. Several important things happened there. Heidelberg was also a Reformation center. And if you go to this university, there are footsteps cut out on 2 stairs where Luther and Calvin preached to the students and faculty in the early days of the Reformation. Ruprecht and his line later on decided, well, actually one of his descendants, adopted Protestantism. So they switched the church from a Catholic to a Protestant mode. And that happened over history several times. It would switch back to Catholic and then it would switch back to Protestant. But has anybody here heard of the Heidelberg Catechism? Okay, the Heidelberg Catechism was founded in this town by town professors, university professors, and theologians. And in our church is where it received its first hearing. If you're a Lutheran of a certain type, you know the Heidelberg Catechism is still very influential. And so here's one of the early manuscripts. Now this manuscript was kept in the church. In fact, there were 8,800 manuscripts kept in the church. Very old ones, 9th century, up to contemporary theology. This is a little weird picture, but the church was so divided about whether to be Catholic or Protestant that in 1718, it built a big wooden wall between the front of the church, called the apse, and the nave, and the Protestants met in the nave, and the Catholics met in the apse. It was a smaller congregation. So they met in the apse. And that went on until 1936, when the Third Reich interrupted all church practices and the rise of Hitler's Nazi regime. So this is just a little reminder that the church also, the nave was Protestant and the apse was really more Catholic in use for many centuries. Now, the situation is this. The university is having its 600th anniversary, and because of that, we're going to celebrate historically by commissioning 22 brand new windows for this site, which is largely a historical site more than an active church. And these are the windows. They're huge. They're like three stories high. So this is not a small commission. Now, we have the word of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Germany that they will raise the money for this. So we don't have to worry about money. The old windows are non-distinctive. Many of them were put in after the 1800s. We don't know what the original windows were like. There's no record of those. So we don't know what style was in the windows. Some of the windows were knocked out during World War II or during the 30 Years' War in 1622 on. Some of the windows were destroyed, and some of the windows are so old and poorly made that they've slumped. And so very old stained glass is still a liquid, and it slumps to the bottom, and then it pulls itself out of its mullions or its structure. So you have to replace it unless it's really well made at the beginning. Like Chartres Cathedral is really well made if you've ever been there, and it won't do this, but it still had to be renovated for millions of dollars. Glass is a temporary thing. And then some of the windows, these are the ones that are actually falling apart. They don't look bad now, but they will be bad. And some of the windows actually clash with the stonework inside of the church because they have this orangey color. So we don't like that. And here's one that looks pretty good too, but there's holes in the bottom and, you know, problems meteorologically. Weather getting inside the church. This church, as I said, is a tourist stop in Heidelberg, and most of the tourists who go in are not Christian or religious at all. They go in for the history, and they go in to learn. It's also very picturesque, but it's right at the end of the main shopping route. So you just end up there in a plaza with coffee shops and everything around. And it's really busy in Heidelberg during the summer. Hundreds of tourists. So with this window scheme, we potentially have the ability to put our church even more on the map than it is in the world of culture. And we could draw hundreds more people to our church and do whatever we want with them once they get there, right? Presumably, if we have a really amazing window program. Now, I mentioned the library. The library began, it was stolen first from Charlemagne. After Charlemagne died, so it began in the 9th century. This is an inventory, and we have lots of inventories. It was then put into top galleries here of this church. Now, this church didn't used to have these galleries. They were built so the library could be housed in the top. So the bottom floor in the old days In the 1400s, you'd have worship. The top floors, you'd have these books, and sometimes famous books like the De Trinitate, one of the original earliest versions by Augustine. It was just on a pedestal chained to a lectern for anybody to look at. So it's a very important part. You had ancient languages. You had one of the best theological libraries outside of the Vatican, and this is throughout the 1400s, the Midrash and the Targum, very old copies from the Middle East that had been preserved, were in this library. I said there were 8,800 volumes. You had all kinds of, again, Middle Eastern languages. Here you see Arabic. but then you also had mathematical treatises, such as treatises from Pythagoras, passed through the Arabic scribes back into medieval history. And you had a lot of medical journals, but thank goodness they don't do medicine that way anymore. You also had original Reformation manuscripts. Now here you have a copy, a hand copy of Romans with Luther's marginalia. Luther actually wrote on this manuscript. There's a lot of early Reformation texts as well. In other words, he created this side column to put his commentary on the side. So you also had medical texts like this much later, which, as I say, I'm really glad they don't do medicine this way. But the whole thing was a huge headache because the Pope, Gregory the 15th, during the 1600s, was very jealous of this library. This library rivaled the Bodleian at Oxford at the time. And it also rivaled the Vatican's own library with scientific texts, astrology, mathematics, a huge theological, you know, section. And so what did the Pope do? But during the 30 Years' War, when Heidelberg was in turmoil, the Pope stole the library, basically. Took it off in 152 carts, these 8,800 books, and just kept it. And that's where it is today. It's part of the Vatican Library, but because of some of the notes, we know which manuscripts belong where. So this has been a big headache. So here's the thing. For this particular exhibition in 1986, let's pretend we're living in the 1970s, but we'd have to wear embarrassing clothes. Anyway, so let's pretend we're living in the 1970s, and we know that this event is coming up, and the Vatican has agreed to send 600 manuscripts back temporarily to be shown in the church during our special celebrations of our church. And we've gone through already a huge selection of artists, and we've chosen Johannes Schrider. So we don't have to do that much, but as a commissioning agency, we've chosen this artist. Now, we happen to know, because he's talked to us, that he is actually a Christian. This is really unusual. He's one of the top 10 glass designers in the world, and he's a Christian, actually active Christian. That there's nobody else like him in the world, in fact. So it seems to be a very appropriate choice. He has done all kinds of styles, including the one I showed you before with the altar and the fire coming down. Sometimes he'll do a meditative window. These are actually innovative technologically. This particular chapel is for a nunnery, and it's completely three-sided, made of glass. And so this is a technological achievement because it changes color as the sun, you know, comes and goes and sets and rises, so it's beautiful. But also, there in the center, there's a convex mirror here, so that if you're sitting in the pews, you can see everybody else in the room with you, and that's a new type of vocabulary. That's what we're interested in. The shatter lines are like a conversation, and they relate to the fact that the world is fallen, but that it will be resolved. You know, the veil is torn, as you see in that dark blue area, but with the knowledge that it will be resolved in time. Here is another type of style that he does. The wound represents both Christ's wounds as well as Germany's wounds from the Holocaust. We don't know if they're being wrapped up or unrevealed because they've healed to a point where they can be revealed again. And we don't know if these are These are strands that relate to the scrolls of Bible, or if the parchment scrolls, or if these are timelines, or if these are grave clothes. But there can be all of those things. So this is a very contemporary type of art because it's multi-layered. This is something he did also, which is grave clothes that are being slowly taken away to show the, this is where the Eucharist happens in this particular church. And so those little red bubbles are meant to represent the wafers of Eucharist, but also the blood of Christ escaping from the grave clothes. And you'll notice there's always a white border of some sort or a border of some sort because the window is protection from the outside world. And you're in the church where supposedly you are more protected under the will of God. And that's what this whole terminology is about. Here, you have a renovation of a church that was completely bombed out in the war. And you have the veil and the border kind of either being put up or falling off. So there's a metaphor in time in this approach. Now I'm just going to have to move quickly. And that's the whole room. Unfortunately, only available in black and white, so it's really quite sublime. So he's not afraid to use limited color. This is for a modern church, which had nothing he could work off of in terms of style. So he took actual blood spots, because he had been very sick in his life and had to be inoculated every day, and he made a whole series called Little Passion. The passion being the passion of Christ, and these little blood spots on Band-Aids, and then he translated these into the same seating arrangement that you have in this actual church. And each blood spot is meticulously crafted and completely different from the other one next to it. So these come from real life, but they're weird, you know, because we think of it as gory. But they represent us. They also represent drops of blood shed for us, sitting in this configuration of the church. And the white veil coming down is the Holy Spirit, generally, that you see on the left side. That means the Holy Spirit. The fragment and shatter lines, again, represent the fact that we don't see completion yet, but that we long for it. So that's some of his meaning. Here's another Band-Aid, Little Passion. So he's appropriative. I'm just going to move on. I just want to show you quickly the process, the process that we'll go through, because we're going to look at sketches, and then you're going to have to decide what you want to do. You said we go till 20 after. Okay, so I'm going to spend 5 more minutes. Of course, there's always the napkin stage where you sketch stuff out, and then you go to the finished window, but there's several stops between that. Not to mention ours, but you have what's called a cartoon, which is the actual size of the window. And if you can see this at all, some of them are so large they don't even fit in his studio, but he rolls them up and that's how he works on them. So he creates an accurate graphic image. Here in this case, there are actually little numbers on these lines that are drawn in charcoal. This can all be directly emulated in the glassmaking process because we're in the 20th century. So it's actually color-coded for the glass maker. No glass designer makes his own glass. This is the kind of sketch we'll be looking at to decide if we want to accept these windows. So it'll be very close to what actually gets made. This is Schreider and his wife who works with him, and they have Bible studies in their house, and I mean, they're very active Christians, and she's an artist as well. Here they are picking out a color in a 2-story high window for the very top square. It's only this big, but it took them an hour to find just the right shade of red. So you actually proofread windows. He goes to the fabrication studio and he proofreads the window and he makes marks on it. And then he also says, let's try another color. And it's all stuck together with wax. So they just pop out the piece and put a new piece in based on his pattern. So he proofreads the window. Here he is pointing at one of his sketches. And here's a sketch of an unusual installation because it's the only one he's used that includes clear glass. So just look at some of the elements. But this church had radiators along the bottom, so he decided he better take those into account. So those are little spaces that he made for the radiators. The reason that you have clear glass here is that this is a church called Church of the Reconciliation. And he felt that instead of being veiled from the outside, this church needed to be able to see out to it. And you can see it's a very modern type of church. So he's very accommodating. So because of the library history of our church, he's come up with a scheme, and this is our church, and all of these in the nave represent the red scheme, which will be human intellectual practices that were featured in the library. And then up at the apse at the top, he has a prophet window, a Torah window. He has a Reformation window that would have the texts of Luther in it. He has at the very, very important part where the altar is, up at the very top, he has the Paternoster, or the Lord's Prayer window, in about 28 languages, but not in a, kind of artistically arranged. And the Magnificat window is next to that, which is the praise from Luke. So here's again the interior that we're talking about. There's a light sandstone type of stone that and white walls and some remnants of design, but the church has been burned many times. It's had things ripped out of it. You know, it's changed a lot. So now I'm going to show you several designs. And so remember the title. In fact, you might want to jot it down. But I'm just going to show you what he has come up with for our church. Except I'm running out of time. So I might just go for one or two. But here is the first design that we see. It's called the physics window. The physics window celebrates two things. The paradox that when human ingenuity creates great things, it also creates problems. So what do you see in the middle of this? Right, you see Einstein's relativity formula. Now, Einstein's relativity formula seems to be escaping out of a rip in the veil. The veil represents all those parchment pages that you saw in the library, so it's a direct quote, but it's also contemporary because it's on computer paper. If you look at the top, there's sprocketed computer paper that's meant to make this more relevant to the 1970s. Down at the very bottom, there's a date, October 6, 1945. Anybody know what that is? Was anybody alive then? No, anyway. Hey, all right. What is it? Well, this was the bombing of Hiroshima. It is August 6th. Right. I read it wrong myself. So, and at the very top there, you have Bible verses, and this is really unusual. He doesn't do this, but they're in German, and one of them says, it's from Isaiah, and it says, I will never forsake you. The other one is from 1 Peter, I believe, and it says the world will end in a fiery conflagration. So that's a bit odd, but those are put together. And then there's a fireball at the bottom, which is the earthly zone. But at the top, in the God zone, there's just red, the blood of Christ, veiling the whole design, and this arrow coming down with white, which usually means the Spirit. And you also have a white stripe on the left side showing you that the Spirit is present. So that's the physics window. Here's the close-up of the design. And the idea is that eventually the red glowing behind everything, I'm just going to skip this image, is going to come through all the holes and rips and eventually redeem the entire window, the entire practice of human intellect. So here you have the economy window. The economy window is directly appropriated from a stock market report. It is a paradox because if you have stocks, you rush out and you get the newspaper and you check all these values and you decide if you're worth more or less. But the next day, you throw it out, or you wrap fish in it. It's newspaper. It's useless information. It only lasts so long. So here you have this kind of old manuscript page that's starting to fragment. There's a section with a cross through it. That's a section titled Assurances. And down at the very bottom on the right side, there's a section titled Renten, which is pension. And so by the time you're ready to leave this world and depart out of the bottom of that, you will be possibly quantified by these values, these pension values. So very, remember, our audience is not Christian essentially. And so there's a dialogue starting here. I'll just show you one more, the medical window. So we looked at physics, economy, medical window. Medical window starts with a baby's heartbeat up at the top, and then it proceeds all the way through, kind of like the decades of life. And then there's a very subtle downturn right here. We have any medical people? That's a heart attack. And eventually we have the cessation of the heartbeat until we get the flat line. And this cross is actually what is used to indicate time of death. And yet, the story doesn't end here. We have this kind of indication of an escape, and then we have a veiled section, and we don't know what is there. So here's my question. You have to kind of jot this down. You have four possible options, and you can make me go back to anything else you want to. And I'll just very quickly show you some of the other designs. They all have multi-layered meanings and sources. That one's very hard to assess visually, but it's a lot of book titles. These are the music windows. those have Bach and some avant-garde. All the disciplines are covered. This is the biology window with DNA. This is the computer window with a barcode in it. And this is the front of the church. So we've looked at physics, economy, and medical. Here's what you have to decide first as individuals, and then for 5 minutes, we have to come to a consensus as a group. That's what the hard part is. Okay. The first alternative you can vote for is, would you accept this window scheme as is, pretty much? Trust the artist. Of course, he'll work out some of the bugs. Second, would you accept this scheme, but ask for some other sketches? Because you don't think the medical window, or you don't like the barcode, or would you ask for some other sketches along this line? Okay, so that's second. Third, would you accept this, except make him do one of his other styles, so completely change and go into some of those other styles we looked at, either abstract or veils. And fourth, would you simply cancel the commission because you don't like it, which is possible too. All right, so the first one is a yes, yes, yes as it is. The second one is a yes, yes, but change it. You know, change some of the sketches. Third one is yes, Schreider, but change the style. Fourth one is no, don't want it. Think about all the contextual things. And can you put the lights up a little bit, somebody? Thank you. You've been so helpful. Will you be secretary again too? So do I have anybody here who would say yes, yes? I have a one, I have a two. No, this is a tourist church. Yeah, it's a tourist church. There are still things going on in there, but it's mainly weddings, baptisms, no exorcisms, of course. But so I have a yes, yes. I think maybe I have four, five. Okay, remember who you are. How many would like this scheme but with some changes? I have a one, I have a two, I have a three, four, I have four. How many would say, I'll keep Schreider because he's great, but give me something else? Oh, so that means how many number fours do I have? You didn't vote. You didn't vote. So cancel, essentially cancel Schreider. You got to vote something. Okay, two, add a two there. Now, can I please, well, we don't really have time because we have approximately 7 minutes, but what you vote on your own is one thing. Normally what I would like to do is quickly get you into a group with a mixture of votes, except we don't have any threes and we only have one four. So can I please have you try to find how many ones? Okay, here are your ones. Could a two please sit next to a one? So keep your hands raised. So could a two, well, they'll tell you. Could a two, can I have two twos, in fact, because we have more twos, right? Can I have two twos move over and sit by a one? Why don't you go up there? Okay, what you're going to do is you have 5 minutes now to argue for a consensus. And then, well, you guys, you're undifferentiated, so I just can't have three ones or three twos sitting together. So can you arrange that for me? Well, we only have 1-4, so there's the four. Who's another three? And it's really quick, so. What? I know, I saw you. I saw you. Are you going to join a group? Okay, I did see you, yeah. Watch out there. Now, you can ask me any questions you want to make your decision. Make sure you all have input, though. See, like, if you guys can't hear, why don't you turn around and why don't you four work together? So you got to decide yes, yes, a yes, but no. You got to turn around. Oh, are you going? All right.